Listening Library presents The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aiken. Read for you by Lizza Aiken. Hello, my name's Lizza Aiken. Many know of the book The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, but few know the story behind it. When my mother, Joan Aiken, first read it aloud to me 50 years ago, even I didn't fully realise the struggle she'd been through, or how long she'd been waiting to complete the story. From its dramatic opening, it was dusk, winter dusk, in the snowy, wolf-filled park of the great house of Willoughby Chase, to its glorious and satisfying conclusion, The Wolves of Willoughby Chase sweeps readers into another world. My mother created an imaginary historical age where train travellers carry muskets and fowling pieces to defend themselves from ravening wolves, where the rich dine on oyster patties, trifle and champagne while wearing ermines and diamonds, but where a reversal of fortune can lead even the most affluent to ruin and starvation. This is not a fantasy where troubles are whisked away by magic. It's a vivid evocation of a grim but entirely believable historical era, the forerunner of many other Gothic parodies, like the stories of Edward Gorey, whose illustration made the cover of The Wolves of Willoughby Chase so memorable. But what you would never guess from the astonishing self-confidence of my mother's writing is that this book was almost never written. For nearly 10 years before she arrived at her own happy ending, my mother faced as many trials and tribulations as her heroines Bonnie and Sylvia. When the book was finally published, having survived some adventures of its own — it was actually lost for a year by one publisher and then turned down by another when my mother refused to take out the wolves — it was immediately hailed by Time magazine as a genuine small masterpiece. And so it seems to be, for it has never been out of print, and it's been translated into dozens of languages, becoming a classic of children's literature. It all began in the autumn of 1953, when England was still recovering from the ravages of World War II. My mother, recently established with a home, a husband, and 2 small children, was chopping wood for the fireplace and remembering all the pleasure that she had gained from reading during her own childhood. Home-schooled until the age of 12, in the isolated village where she grew up, she'd spent most of her days with imaginary friends from the worlds of the great dramatic storytellers of the 19th century. Now she realised she could write a book herself, using the most delightful ingredients, and some of the scariest, from the classic stories of Charles Dickens or Charlotte Bronte or the many others whose work she'd enjoyed, so that they would pass on to the next generation. "I can write a marvellous adventure," my mother thought. "I can fill it with all my favourite things. Not just one dreadful villain, but a whole pack of them, with castles and dungeons, banquets and ballrooms, shipwrecks and secret passages. And above all, heroic orphans facing unbelievable odds and triumphing through their own tremendous efforts." She bought an old table and installed it in the corner of her bedroom, and on her 29th birthday, the date September the 4th, proudly inscribed on the first page of an old notebook, she began to write. But as so often happened in the stories my mother had read, disaster struck, and the first few chapters of the book she'd so eagerly started writing had to be put aside. My father fell ill and lost his job, and my parents were obliged to sell our home. Less than 2 years later, my father died. This was not the moment to delve into a world of make-believe misfortunes, for now my mother had to surmount a series of very real obstacles and take care of herself and 2 young children until she could find a new home, and a cat, of whom more later. Her troubles and responsibilities during these years deepened her writing immeasurably, taking it beyond the mere tongue-in-cheek parody she'd first imagined. She'd certainly revelled in the melodrama she'd read as a child, but now that she'd experienced tragedy and poverty herself, she could write about them with authority. The Wolves of Willoughby Chase is the story my mother started and sadly put aside when my brother and I, aged 5 and 3, and still stricken by the death of our father, were sent away to school while she found work to support us. It remained an inspiration in the back of her mind until nearly 10 years after she'd first written those opening lines, when we were all under our own roof once again. while my brother and I were happily running around banging nails into the walls so we could hang up our clothes, she was finally able to get out her old notebook. As if no time had passed, she sat down to finish her story. And as she entertained us with the adventures of Bonnie and Sylvia and Simon, she must have felt a good deal of relief, knowing she could also bring them through their troubles to a happy ending. And do you remember I mentioned a cat? You may have seen that this book is dedicated to John and Elizabeth, my brother and me, and Torquemada. The last member of our company, Torquemada, was a large, gentle black-and-white cat who lived on a friend's houseboat, minding his own business and fishing for his dinner, until two ferocious Abyssinian cats moved into his territory and drove him into hiding. Terrified, hungry, and miserable, he crouched in a ship's funnel until my mother rescued him and brought him to live with us. She gave him his extraordinary name to restore his courage, and he sat in the open window by her typewriter, guarding the house from visitors while she copied out her story. As she read each newly typed chapter aloud to the three of us and the story neared its end, I remember how I especially loved the orphan's gentle, healing journey through the green hills and valleys of England. We were like those orphans of the storm, and she'd brought us safely home.
Chapter 1. It was dusk, winter dusk. Snow lay white and shining over the pleated hills, and icicles hung from the forest trees. Snow lay piled on the dark road across Willoughby Wold, but from dawn men had been clearing it with brooms and shovels. There were hundreds of them at work, wrapped in sacking because of the bitter cold, and keeping together in groups for fear of the wolves, grown savage and reckless from hunger. Snow lay thick, too, upon the roof of Willoughby Chase, the great house that stood on an open eminence in the heart of the Wold. But for all that, the Chase looked an inviting home, a warm and welcoming stronghold. Its rosy herringbone brick was bright and well cared for. Its numerous turrets and battlements stood up sharp against the sky, and the crenellated balconies, corniced with snow, each held a golden square of window. The house was all alight within, and the joyous hubbub of its activity contrasted with the sombre sighing of the wind and the hideous howling of the wolves without. In the nursery, a little girl was impatiently dancing up and down before the great window, 14 feet high, which faced out over the park and commanded the long black expanse of road. "Will she be here soon, Patton? Will she?" was her continual cry. "We shall hear soon enough, I dare say, Miss Bonnie," was the inevitable reply from her maid, who, on hands and knees in front of the fire, was folding and goffering the frills of 20 lace petticoats. The little girl turned again to her impatient vigil. She had climbed up onto the window seat, the better to survey the snowy park, and was jumping on its well-sprung cushions, covered in crimson satin. Each time she bounced, she nearly hit the ceiling. "Give over, Miss Bonnie, do," said Patton, after a while. "Look at the dust you're raising. I can hardly see my tongs. Come and sit by the fire. We shall hear soon enough when the train's due." Bonnie left her perch reluctantly enough and came to sit by the fire. She was a slender creature, small for her age, but rosy-cheeked, with a mass of tumbled black locks falling to her shoulders and two brilliant blue eyes, equally ready to dance with laughter or flash with indignation. Her square chin also gave promise of a powerful and obstinate temper, not always perfectly controlled. But her mouth was sweet, and she could be very thoughtful on occasion, as now, when she sat gazing into the fire, piled high on its two carved alabaster wolfhounds. "I hope the train hasn't been delayed by wolves," she said presently. "Nonsense, Miss Bonnie, dear. Don't worry your pretty head with thoughts like that," replied Patton. "You know the porters and station master have been practising with their muskets and fowling pieces all the week." At that moment, there was a commotion from downstairs, and Bonnie turned, her face alight with expectancy.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?